go with the show.
We try to.
Welcome back, my friends, to the
show that never ends.
That's right.
We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside.
Who are you?
I'm Don Moore. And you are?
Al Val. I shouldn't give that much information.
Otherwise known as Dr. Morbius from Parts Unknown.
Yeah, that's right. We should always use pseudonyms. Anyway, we have been reading comics this week, and we will be talking about them, I gather. What have you been reading, Don?
I think we save that for the second half of the show.
Well, I thought we could do things differently. Okay. Okay. So what are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk about the great John Severin?
Yeah, we talked about John Severin in past shows, and we worked with a woman that was an editor at Crag Magazine.
Don't use names.
I didn't say any name.
Oh, yeah.
But she's quite nice, and I just mentioned to her, did you know John Severin died a while back? She was extremely upset about it, nothing but good things about John Severin. She had said that she really couldn't wait in the mail to get the flats John Severin sent, see the pages. And one thing she'd said was the other artist drew on paper. He drew on a Bristol board.
The other artist drew on paper?
Yeah.
Like on flimsy paper?
Yeah, on regular paper, and they'd roll it up and send it in tubes.
Are you kidding? No, that's news, man. I never heard of that before.
But she said, John Severin, I know he used dual-tone paper, which you
could
tell.
Sure, it was beautiful, yeah. We'll put some examples of it.
But he sent it flat, always sent it flat. And one thing I never would have thought of, she said he always did the front story, the main story.
Yeah.
And he did the cover. And she said it was to the chagrin of the publisher, the guy that ran the magazine. He would send the story in first, and he'd send the cover later. And she said the editor would get upset about it, saying, I'd rather have it'd be easier if you sent the cover first, because you could prepare the whole magazine. And then, put
so the magazine was based upon his work, his covers and
stuff
like that?
Yeah, well, he did the covers. And
did she say anything about whether he was asked, whether he was given, an idea for a cover, or did he just come up with something out of his...
A lot of times, sometimes the cover was just, the main character, that
Sylvester P. Smythe.
Yeah, the janitor.
Yeah.
He would always, I remember one of them, he was using a hammer and he was going to hit his thumb instead of the nail. But a lot of times the covers I saw, they did relate to the main story.
Okay.
So like if they had a parody of Star Wars, the cover,
Well, Mad would do the same thing too.
Exactly.
Not always, but.
Yeah, same as Crack. Sometimes Crack would just be some generic cover. Sometimes it relate to the story. But I remember John Severin doing more than just the main story in the cover. I remember him having other pieces.
Yeah. You know what he would do a lot? He would do stuff for... Cracked had another magazine called from... I think it was called either Monster Laughs or For Monsters Only. And he would do humorous horror cartoons and stuff like that. And he was a great caricaturist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Now, was Cracked published by Charlton? Or was that the other one?
It
was Cracked. There was one called Sick.
That was Joe Simon's magazine.
Yeah, so. I'm wondering if that's the one that was. We'll get the info after the break, and we'll get the.
Oh, will we?
Yes, we will. I will. I will anyway.
She said that he would. The publisher would be a little upset about it, saying it'd help if he had the cover first. And John Severin's comment was, he wanted to save the cover after he was warmed up and had his game on. Instead of, when you did a story, you get more into it, which I understand. And she said that, it was logic, but, just different interests for different areas. But she had made a comment that he absolutely loved John Wayne. He was always quoting John Wayne. He talked about John Wayne. And she said he loved him. And she said, have you ever met John Wayne? He said, no, but my brother did. Kind of find out his brother's Tyrone Powers, the actor.
Wow.
And I never knew that.
You probably worked with him.
I told her about one of the past shows we did after he's gone, and we made a comment about, well, goodbye. He says, you never stop being good. And a lot of times I tell people something like that, I always have to explain that a lot of professionals, as time goes on, they start putting less and less into it. You know, it's just, and it's, there's always the comment, phoning it in. Not that they're doing bad work, it's just pales compared to what their earlier work was when they were younger. And sometimes I say younger, even in the 40s and 50s. But John Severn, his later work, to me, was just as vibrant as the work he did when he was a younger man. It never stopped. He never seemed to stop putting as much effort into it. And I didn't have to tell her that. When I just said, you never stop being good, she immediately said, oh, he was a very strong believer in being a good citizen. You see, he always had a very strong work ethic and felt it. You should sit there and work as hard as you can to make the world a better place and be good to other people. And so I can certainly understand that he would never stop being, bringing his best game to it. So, you know, props to John Severn, you know, props to Crack Magazine, which is down in Clearwater.
It was?
Yeah, she lived in Clearwater.
Oh, but the magazine was published in New York, though,
yeah,
for
well,
sure. Now it's even, I think it's a website now or something.
Yeah, there is crack.com I hear about, but it's not the same. It's not even related to it, is it? I think it's just a name.
I think Mad still comes out in its newsstands, I think.
Yeah, they were coming out, I think, four times a year or something.
Something like that. I mean, are there any humor magazines around anymore? I guess besides the Archies. Oh, and thanks for the Archies, by the way.
No problem.
But yeah, are there any humor magazines left around anymore? I mean, National Lampoon. I think Lampoon's still around.
Really?
I think. Because I know Heavy Metal's still around, but that's not exactly a humor magazine.
I guess I'd say, are there any magazines left around? But
yeah, there are, but there's no stores that carry them, only Barnes & Noble.
Well, you know, that's the weird thing, was you go in, used to be convenience stores, you go in and there's just a huge rack of magazines. And
Publish has magazines.
Yeah, grocery stores that have them, they're always at the front of the store. And now when I do see them, they're like, oh, they're here. And it's not very inviting.
No.
And when Borders is around, I go by Borders and I'm shocked that they had like four racks of magazines, huge bookstore racks of magazines. So I didn't realize there was so many put out. And I don't know, a lot of times it just seems to me like they all kind of look the same. But no, I magazines aren't something I really notice too much anymore, so if there are a lot of them, I...
Well, if you go to Barnes & Noble, you'll see like the usual four or five magazine racks, and there's a lot of interesting things out there. Publix has them. But they're more like the GQs and the, you know, the more mainstream, you know, that general, you know, general public, not the oddball things that we like or whatever. But if you go to Barnes & Noble, you'll see the horror mag, you'll see illustration magazine, you'll see the cool British magazines like Uncut and Mojo that do like in-depth articles on rock and roll and stuff like that. They're still a lot, but problem with magazines is the same problem with comic books these days. They're freaking too expensive. Magazines are now minimum for like something specialized, like Scary Monsters or something, or Famous Monsters or whatever. It's like $9 or $10.
Yeah, paper costs went up a whole lot in towards the end of the '90s. They just started tripling, and that was an issue. You know, we work in publishing. And all of a sudden, and we use paper for everything. There was paper, you know, we did multiple printouts at work, and there was different separations.
Yeah.
And we went through paper like you know, a human being drinks water. And that was an issue. And a lot of comic books, like Grew, stopped publishing because of the paper cost was cutting into the profit.
I know that.
Yeah, in the late 90s, Grew, they were with Epic for 120 issues. And then they moved over to Image, when Bone moved to Image. But a lot of it was the distribution stuff that was going on with Diamond and everything else. But then some of these smaller independent books, or, you know, creator-owned books, went over to Image. And Grew was with them for 12 issues. And I think it was the 11th issue, they said, next issue we're going to have an announcement about the future of this comic. And I thought, okay, I wasn't really thinking much about it, I just thought, I wonder what that is. And then the last issue, it said, well, about the future of this comic, there isn't one. And they basically talked about Image has been a fantastic publisher, and they appreciate it. We were talking about the rising paper costs and how it's cut into their margins. It says, before we can make a, you know, we can make a living doing the comic. And they said, well, now we're paying most of the money for paper. It's just not viable. So they dropped it. They pop up once in a while on Dark Horse. But he said, you'll see that with a lot of your favorite comics, they're going to kind of stop doing it because of that or change the format. And he was absolutely right. The other thing is the circulation has gone down. You know,
yeah.
Video games are extremely popular. You know, DVDs. You can go on the internet and find... You can find this stuff for free, but it's not quite the same as a magazine. It's not always as in-depth, but, you know, and it's not always right either, but not that magazines always were right, but, you know, they check references and stuff, supposedly.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering what's going to happen to the day when, like, you know, at some point they're going to start charging you for all the information you get online or a lot of it. So is our reading materials going to come back? Because that's the only reason why, you know, people are going to the internet, because it's convenient, but it's also because it's free. Yeah, a lot of it, you know. I mean, magazines cost you $10, or, you know, buying a book costs you more. Go to the internet and, like, get the information there, usually for nothing. So I'm wondering if that the tide's going to turn when they start, like, pulling, you know, stunts like that on here. That might never happen.
You never know. I mean... We talk
what if they start charging a buck for Wikipedia, where a lot of people get their information or misinformation out of, you know?
Well, that's an issue, and we talk about this all the time, but remember that movie, You Got Mail, with Tom Hanks?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, basically it was, who was the woman?
Oh, God, she was in that movie of The Doors. I know her, I see her face.
The female actress in the movie, the female character, she had a bookstore. It was, you know, doing fine, something she liked, and they were really involved with the community. And then Tom Hanks came in with one of those huge bookstores, you know, like Borders or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million.
Meg something? What was her name? Meg, Meg Ryan.
Oh, Meg Ryan.
Meg Ryan.
But anyway, that was the story, you know, was basically these two met from, you know, opposing sides. And his bookstore, put at the end of the movie, her bookstore was over. It was gone. And that's what they're talking about. These super mega stores are coming in. Well, not too long later, the super mega stores are gone.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just remember Vinyl Records, as we talked about on the show. I was surprised. I was at the mall store with my daughter. Hot Gimmick. They sell records.
Where is this?
It's at every mall. Hot Gimmick. It's one of those. It started out as a goth store, and I guess it's still kind of. But they have superhero shirts. They have cartoon character stuff, and sometimes even Hello Kitty stuff. But you know, it's like a Spencer's. You go in there, they got loud music.
Oh yeah, 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 right. And they have vinyl.
They have, you know, there's two wall racks of vinyl.
How much was it? $20 or something?
$22 is the average price of a vinyl record.
What albums did they have? That anything that jumped out at you?
A lot of bands I don't know, but there were some albums that I had seen. That, I mean, it wasn't
well,
just
like,
all
I haven't
bands.
Seen Beatles or Zeppelin or anything
I didn't
like
see
that.
Any bands I listened to. They might have had an R.E.M. album in there.
Oh, that's interesting.
But, like I said, there were bands that have heard some of them. Some of them are new. It's a different audience to what I am, you know.
Okay.
But one time my daughter was small, she went in there, and this is when the store was more goth. Everybody's store is very nice. It's a very professionally run store, and even though they all have, like, nose rings and spiked hair and, you know, Beetlejuice-look makeup on. But one time
I'm surprised that crap's not over with you. That's kind of like,
well,
so...
this is years ago in the early 2000s.
Oh, this isn't now. Oh, okay.
Well, it's still around. It's relaxed more, but in the early 2000s, I was there with my daughter who just started middle school, and I feel out of place. I'm trying not to be, you know,
not
intrusive in the store, and, well, and I'm just standing there trying to stay out of everybody's way, which is hard because I'm really big. And my daughter's looking around, I'm trying to stay everybody's way, and there's this other man, I'm guessing about 50, looks completely out of place, and he looks over and he says, well, let's see, we're both... I can't remember what he said exactly, but basically he's letting me know that, like him, I'm out of place. Well, I wouldn't argue, but I just felt kind of silly. It's like we turn to the old dads on Leave It to Beaver when Wally's out with his friends at the mall shop listening to rock and roll. You know?
There you go.
But, But nevertheless, they have vinyl records. I told him, oh, you know they sell vinyl here? Oh, yeah. And I was really surprised. Like I said, I hear it's making a comeback. A good friend of mine who lives in Tallahassee now, he's got a massive music collection. He buys CDs, but he's been getting vinyl. He goes to the used record stores. He goes everywhere. But I'm guessing $22.
It's a little high.
Well, it's a mall store.
And
I don't
know. It's better quality vinyl than some of the crap we used to get that wore out after two.
Yeah, well, that was after the petroleum went up so high and the gas crisis in 74.
Yeah.
Those of you that weren't around in 74, gas was 24 cents a gallon. And then at one point, OPEC raised it, and it went so high, and they were saying it's going to go up to $1 a gallon. This is in, like, 73. What? And I used to mow lawns as a kid. I'd ride my bike with a half-gallon can, and, you know, I'd get 15 cents worth of gas, last me all day mowing lawns. And the gas is always 24 cents. And I told Dad it's been 24 cents for 3 or 4 years. Well, that's the problem. It's been 24 cents forever. Well, next thing you know, it went up to 50 cents. And, you know, it kept going. But in 74, there was a huge oil crisis. That's when they started offering a lot more self-service gas because it was a little bit cheaper. It all became self-service gas. Record prices went up. And vinyl records got really thin. Mm-hmm. My record collection had some before 74, and they're really thick, and they could almost deflect a bullet if you were shot and used as a shield. And they got real thin and flimsy, and it finally was a petroleum product. And so they started getting really flimsy to where they were almost flex discs, and I just, that was sad.
I think also you got to take it into consideration, that's part of it. But the other part about it was that was like the main musical consumption. So they were just cranking out records upon records upon records. They obviously they got cheap. When you bought imports, the quality of the vinyl was usually better when you bought an import because they weren't as mass produced as they were here. So you know usually the worst ones were, I think it was RCA or something like that. They had this new, I forgot what it was called, but I remember I got some Bowie record. I think it was Hunky Dory. And there's a couple of Lou Reed's, and like the vinyl is like you said, you just, it's like paper almost. You can see through it. And I'm like, how many times can this be played before the needle wears right through it?
Yeah. Well, the guy we worked with, he was a Vietnam vet. He was in the Marines in Vietnam. And he was telling me one of his buddies went to Hong Kong on leave. He came back with a huge stack of vinyl records that he got for almost nothing. And he said, he thought, well, that's sweet. And the guy was so proud. He says he played them once in the barracks, and that's all he could play them. He says the vinyl was so soft that as soon as the needle went over them, that was it.
So, yeah, it's like cutting butter or something like that.
Anyway, this is the Vinyl Record Podcast with Don and Al.
Yeah, and listen to more music. Yeah, anyway, Crack Magazine was not, I mean, Crack Magazine was not published by Charlton. It was published by Globe Publishing, different guy. Robert Sproul, I think, is the name.
That's who, yeah, that's
Robert Sproul, yeah.
About.
And the thing, going back to John Sterling, I wanted to mention was, he was one of those guys, when he first started, his style was already kind of, like, set.
Yeah.
He was always good. I've never seen a bad John Severin job. In the early days, he was inked by Will Elder back in EC days.
Yeah,
or whatever.
It was awesome, too.
It was awesome. It's like two geniuses doing it. But then when he went on his own, I mean, he never did a bad job in his life. He was like born with that art style perfected, I think.
Some artists will change. Most artists, if you see their earlier work and you see later work, the style progresses. I mean, not to say it changes a whole lot. You might see them. But if you look at early Joe Kubert work to later Joe Kubert work, Joe Kubert always had a sketchiness to how he drew and felt, and there's a flowing.
Yeah.
And you could tell he was, even though he did pencil work, he was finishing with ink. He was doing a lot of the finish drawing with ink.
Yeah.
But as Joe Kubert went on, it was a lot more confidence, and it was a master. He got very clear and definitive and simpler. Well, simple for Joe Kubert is still detailed for anybody else.
Yeah.
But you can see a difference between, you know, what years he drew it. Mobius was the same way, even though Mobius changed style to style. Even if you read early Jaime Hernandez work, It was just as good, but it was a little more rougher and a little more thicker.
It's finding its way.
Yeah. It's a John Severin, and sometimes you see an artist that starts out pretty good and they never change, and it just looks stagnant, like they never got better. And John Severin was never like that. He started out good. I would say his drawing style changed a whole lot over time.
But he refined it.
He refined it. He did get better, but, I mean, it still stayed within a close perimeter of the earlier work. But it was never like, it was just always, this guy is awesome. Mm-hmm. And, he put as much effort into everything. But it seemed like he found his way pretty soon, and even though he did get better, it was still just fantastic.
The guy that improved a lot from looking at old 50s comics, and I'm going to have a hard time finding examples, but I'll try, was Wally Wood. I saw some book he did in 1950, this Dorothy L'Amour book, and it was just terrible. You could tell it was Wood, but it was terrible. And like a year later, it was like, wow, this guy just got like, you know, infinitely times better. I think it was maybe from working with Joe Orlando or working with other people or whatever, but it was just shocking how much better his work was a year or two later. Yeah, that's something that John Severin never experienced, because he was from day one, his stuff was already solid, and, you know, the draftsmanship was always there. You know, the style evolved. And the thing about artists, what you mentioned before, how sometimes you say their styles get changed and you think they're phoning it in. I'd like to think of it this way. They start off, they develop their style is developed and it goes on for years, and then afterwards I think they refine their work because they get older and stuff like that. You know, like Wood changed. He started off crude, he got way better, then he got real detailed, and by the 60s he kind of simplified the work. It was still Wally Wood, but it wasn't like the clutter that was there in the 50s, because I think it's either through speed or through just kind of like, it's almost like changing, you know, realizing that, you know, I don't need to have all this information when it's just simpler and easier to read when you just have the figure moving and maybe in the background, like, you know, just an image of machinery, you know.
That's what you're bringing up is an argument a lot of people have. Two artists, I think, that do that, Mobius and Jaime Hernandez, when they were younger, they had a lot of detail work in it.
Yeah.
And as it went on, Mobius had that almost a single weight line style, and so did Jaime Hernandez. To me, it was just as fantastic, but they were basically stripping down to just the essentials of what needed to be.
Yeah.
And I know, as I said earlier on the show, Mobius always said that a lot of detail can save a bad drawing. So I know Jaime was doing the same thing. He was trying to bring it down to the essentials and still be strong. Now, they see that. If I did a bad drawing, no matter how much detail I put into it, it's still bad. But I see where they're coming from. But
You know what else helps? I wouldn't say it helps a bad drawing, but it helps a drawing that might not look as strong in black and white as the proper and the good use of color.
Oh,
color,
yes.
Color will change it from, like, you know, sketchy to freaking tight and beautiful sometimes.
Some of these colors that we have now, I mean, I'm not a fan of over-rendering, but there are some colors that still work very simply, like the old colors did.
Yeah.
But yeah, they completely transformed that book. Frank Miller even mentioned that when he was working with Lynn Varley on The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And in an interview, he says he was on that project, he was starting to realize just how important color was. Well, she wasn't just coloring pages. Some of this stuff, she was outright drawing images in the background and transforming everything. And if you ever look at Frank Miller's Dark Knight pages, the black and white stuff, it's pretty sparse. And Lynn Varley's color palette just brings it to life.
Yeah.
Also, those Lone Wolf and Cub covers he did for First Comics.
Mm-hmm.
There's one of them that it really caught me. It was, I think it was a woman, committing seppuku, you know, but there was a screen panel behind it. But what surprised me is the different shades inside the screen panel. Well, that's nice. Come to find out, Frank Miller, he just drew the squares for the screen panel, and she added a simple effect. So, yeah, the coloring changes it. But there are a lot of artists that start out with a lot of heavy drawing and rendering. And as they go on, they start stripping it down fans write in, complain, because, you know, they like the
detail.
They like detail. And they
George
like
Perez.
Who's
great.
George Perez never stopped adding detail, and Walt Simonson is another one. He even said that as a lot of men get older, they start adding less lines. He says, and he said it kind of embarrassed. He says, well, I don't know, I'm getting older, but I'm adding more lines. Well, his compositions and work is extremely strong. He's got a different type of style where his lines is he's... I like sketched work. I like to see the sketch pages, you know, the rough pencil work before the inks. I love inks, but I love seeing the pencil work because there's a vibrance to it that you can't match. It kind of sterilizes it when an inker goes over it. Now, saying that, I love the finished look, but it's a thrill. The only one I can even think of that looks just as vibrant after it's inked is Walt Simonson's work. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Dan Pritchard from Slice Radio, and he mentioned that he felt the same way, and he says, is there any publisher that's ever put out a comic story of just the artist's pencils? I've never heard of it. That would be kind of neat. Is there?
Yeah.
Well, could you give us some examples?
Well, they were colored, you know, coloring. They had rendering, but Nathaniel Dusk by DC, by Gene Colan.
That's absolutely right.
That was done all in pencils.
Cause well, what the first one was,
they were
was
all
black and white.
Four of them were pencils.
Yeah, but there was, I knew there was a, I got, in 1985, I got Nathaniel Dusk too, and it was done in colored pencils, I thought is what it looked like.
No, he would pencil it, and then the inker, then the colorist would color, but it looked like colored pencil, because back then, they didn't have all the Photoshop. I don't think they did, and all that stuff. So it was colored, hand colored with Dr. Martin's inks or whatever. You know, the guides. Remember Dr. Martin inks?
Yeah,
the guideline on the guideline page or whatever. You know, so I think it was colored that way, and then gave it that soft kind of look. But Gene Colan did a Captain America a few years ago, and it was done like 3 or 4 years ago, and it was pencils only. And somebody colored it, and it was muddy, but you could tell it was Gene Colan. It doesn't work right. If you want to pencil it, and pencils only telling the story, it's probably better to be in black and white than it would be in color.
Well, I never saw the first Nathaniel Dusk series, but I thought that was black and white.
Maybe the first one was, but the one that I remember that DC put out, the four-parter, they're all, as far as I remember, they're all in pencils.
Well, I remember I bought that first one of Nathaniel Dusk too, and there's a girl working behind the counter, and I just picked it up, and she goes, oh, I read this. It's so pretty. Which it was. She was absolutely right. I guess she didn't really read comics much, but it caught her curiosity, and I was really impressed. I really liked the look. It was one of my favorite Gene Colan pieces. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, well, the thing about Colan was it was like, besides Tom Palmer and a few others, he was a hard guy to ink because his work was so, like, based on shadows and, you know, kind of like this wispy design things. I mean, when Vince Coletta got a hold of it, it was just like, oh, no, you know. But saying that, when it would reprint the book in his black and white pencils, they were usually pretty nice for the most part. Yeah, I think it was Nathaniel Dusk, and I think there was a DC did a graphic novel, a science fiction graphic novel, and I can't think of the title right now. Again, I'm going to look it up after the break and maybe mention the name. But it was done by Colan and pencils, but they had a guy who colored it, but it wasn't. It made it look tighter in a way. You know, I can't think of it right now. Remember in the 70s or 80s, DC did like 4 or 5 sci-fi graphic novels. One of them was the Marshall Rogers doing the Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, I have that. That's pretty nice.
It was that series. And Gene Colan did one. Well, I'll look it up. I'll look it up after.
Yeah, I never saw that one. Yeah, I will say he was one. I loved to see the pencil work he did, and it was almost like he worked as a painter.
They
weren't tight pencils, and they worked
it
for
was,
them.
Yeah.
And yeah, it would be really hard to ink. And a lot of the times when I saw the work,
unless your name's Tom Palmer.
Yeah, he wasn't. They didn't do him justice.
Well, him and Tom Palmer were like, you know, brothers from different mothers, where they were just perfect for each other. They were born. They're actually like my top 10 artist inker team of all time. They might be in my top 5.
Yeah.
Besides Kirby's, some of Kirby's guys and stuff like that. But Anyway, speaking of breaks, let's take one. You got any tunes we're gonna play?
Well, let's play some Steve Robinson.
Steve Robinson coming up.
There are those who think I'm a man on a mission, man with a vision or two. There are those who would laugh at my fear of decision. I think it's funny too. And I've been a lot of places and I've seen a lot of things and wonder why I know nothing.
Scunthorpe, England, but now he lives with us down here.
Has he got anything coming out soon? Or?
Yeah, it's funny you ask. Absolutely. He and I were talking because, you know, last show you and I did, we played Geneva Wallet. And I was asking, I says, you said that you know, she hasn't put the CD out because I really like her. I'd like to get the CD. And he said, well, it's done. They're just putting finishing touches on it. And he said he did tell Ed Wattell, who worked on her album. He says, well, Don really wants a copy. And he made a comment about, oh, well, that's one copper, you know, one tin in the coppers or something like that. So I guess that's the other issue, is once they finish and put it out, are they going to be able to make the money, you know, to put it out?
Well, they got a better chance of putting it out than not.
Well, I agree. But like I said, I want to buy a copy. I really like her, the two songs I heard. But anyway, Steve and I were talking. Him and Ed's working on a CD. And I guess they got one pretty much ready. But then he sent me, through email, two songs. And God, they're fantastic. It's Steve and a guitar playing. And I absolutely love them. And he said that they're coming out. I guess they're not finished, so we won't ever play them on this show. But I tell you, I love how he plays the guitar. He plays the guitar like a percussion instrument. And he sings and has these fantastic harmonies. Just something else.
Cool.
So anyway, he should have something out sometime.
Sounds good. So it looks like you got some Valerian graphic novels there.
Now, I've talked in the past, I'm a huge fan of J.C. Mezieres and Valerian, the space temporal pilot. Back in 1981 or 82, this company called Dargold USA, who put out all the Asterix books here, they put out four Valerian books, one every year. I absolutely loved it. J.C. Mezieres was a good friend of Mobius. They went to school together. And if you've seen the movie Fifth Element, you saw both of those men work. They gave them production designer credits. But basically, they designed the movie, and the story is even taken from some of their stories. Valerian hasn't been translated in English, except for those four books that I know of and could find. And I've always searched for it. And anyway, this company called, I think it's pronounced Sin Books, out of England. They specialize in taking French graphic novels, translating English, and put them out. And they're doing two Valerian books a year. They're up to six right now. Three of them I've already got. I bought them again because the old Dargold issues I got are falling apart. This stuff is absolutely beautiful. The latest one I got is The Birds of the Master, which I think Al's thumbing through right now. He did that in 1972 or 1973.
Hmm.
And I compare that to some of the American comics you see. It's kind of astounding. But I love the color, a lot of blue light. It's all just unique to me. And I was actually in the middle of reading something else, and these came in the mail, and I read one after another and couldn't put them down. Absolutely, to me, I don't understand why people just don't run out and buy these things. You know. But.
Well, because did they ever put them out in comic book format or promote them otherwise, other than.
Well,
graphic novels?
In the early 80s, they were in all the stores. That's where I picked them up. But I haven't seen them in any stores since.
Well, because even Mobius got mainstream Marvel comic books stuff like that. He never did.
No, he didn't. Very interesting. And the writer of all these is, I think it's...
Christian?
It's P. Christian. I think it's Pierre.
Yeah, Pierre.
But, you know... Way back we started the show, we talked about our five favorite writers. I wanted to put him on there because he, I love these Valerian stories. The artwork is just astounding, but the story is just as strong. He has a lot of philosophy. He always has interesting stories. He talks about sociology and politics. But the female character, Laura Lyon, in these strips, I read these, like I said, in 1981 or 82, and I was shocked at what a strong female character she was. And she stayed, and I was thinking, these stories were done in the 60s and 70s. You always remember how Sue Storm was always so weak, you know, in the Fantastic Four, which a lot of women in American comics were that way, except for Big Barda. But
you'd be surprised. On my blog, Destination Nightmare, my friend Pat does a...
Yes, I read those. Sorry.
Does the My Heroine Addiction about all the female superheroes,
yes.
And there was lots of them. There was lots of them in the 40s and 50s.
Yes, I see those, and they're ones I've never heard of.
Exactly, yeah.
But there were a lot of them.
There were a lot of them. I've never heard of them either. You know, I mean, obviously the Jungle Women, like Sheena and stuff like that, I had heard of. But he had some ones on there that were like, what? Who the heck is this, you know? The weirdest one was that one Fantoma, the woman who, like, flies and her head turns into a skull face or whatever.
Yeah, that's kind of
Fletcher
awesome.
Hanks thing. That's the strangeness.
You know, I'm embarrassed. I'm going to say it anyway. I didn't realize that his heroin addiction was about female heroines.
Yeah, he wasn't talking about it. He's not addicted to
I just
her.
Thought,
it's
okay.
A play on words.
I thought it was a joke, like he was addicted to comics like heroin.
No, it's heroin.
Okay, well, you know, thick as a brick me. I never even gave that a thought, I'm embarrassed to say.
It's about all the heroines.
I've been
time.
Reading this for like, what, a year or 2 years, and I just now got it.
Okay. Hey, you know what? That's cool, man.
What do you mean, slow of mind?
That's cool. No. I mean, he does a good job with those. I don't know. I think we're nearing the end of them, but I'm sure he's got some more coming up. But yeah, he does. He's found a lot of them. There's another one. I think it's called. There's one of them, Madame Strange or something. It was like a demonic woman. They were back in those days. They were just throwing whatever at the wall, you know.
But what I like when I see those that he posts, I like the 40s style. I really like seeing those old movies. I love the women, how they looked, and they're all so glamorous.
Yeah.
And all these female superheroes he has, they always have that really nice hair and earrings and nice makeup. And,
yeah.
You know, it's funny, they are strong women, and when I say that, I grew up reading the Lois Lane, you know, Superman, and all she was like a 50s housewife with a Mamie Eisenhower hairstyle. And even though I guess they drew her as a young woman, she seemed like an old bag to me. And she was doing was trying to snag Superman. And it just irritated me. I mean, when I say that I read these comics, I love Kirk Scaifenberger, but the comics irritate me. But at the same time, if you read the old Superman stuff before Mort Weisinger took over, Lois Lane was a really strong character. She was a really strong reporter. She went on her own. If you see those Fleischer Superman cartoons, you couldn't stop her. She was always, you know, of course Superman had to save her in each cartoon, but
still,
she was a strong character. And then when Mort Weisinger took over, she basically just turned into a really irritating, almost housewife that was out with among all the men. And that's when it changed. And when I'm saying this, and it's absolutely not a slam on Jack Kirby, but all those Marvel comics, the women, for the most part, were pretty weak. I think that's the women Jack Kirby was around is how he saw them. But Sue Storm was always, she was a character I liked a lot. But I remember there was different writers and artists that were always talking about, when I was in high school, that when they took over this comic, they were going to turn Sue Storm into a strong, or Susan Richards into a strong character. But she always turned into the weak milquetoast. Oh, I can't do it. Oh, Reed, help me. And I guess they've changed her since, you know. But when you're reading, you know, the Valerian stuff with Laureline, the female character, and she's absolutely a woman. It's not like they made a man male character and made her look like a woman. She's a woman with a woman's thought process. But she's no nonsense, and at times she'll take over and straighten things out.
No, I'm sorry, it wasn't Madame Strange, Madame Satan, believe it or not. Look at that. I think it's Harry Lucy or something like that drew that, believe it or not. Yeah, he had a Pat's a big fan of his, and he had a realistic style before he did the Archie stuff, and I think I'm pretty sure this is Harry Lucy. The woman looks like she's like, but yeah, look at all this. Well, this was in the Golden Age. You can imagine, you know. I don't know about the rest of the stuff.
It's okay to be called Madam Satan if you're dressed like that.
Yeah, there was a lot of superhero, but something happened. You had Supergirl, you had Wonder Woman, of course, and you know, but most of it was just like my love story or romance comics, or you know, I guess they kind of picked up on. In the 60s, maybe in the late 50s, that it was mostly a boys thing or whatever, you know, whereas in the 30s and 40s, they were just going after everybody, and then somehow or another, It just became a guy thing as opposed to a girl.
Girls
thing.
Did read comics and still
do. The romance ones, or they thought.
Yeah. A friend of ours at work, she's from Columbia, and when she heard Dallas and I talking about comics, she said, I guess she was at her niece's place, and her niece had a bunch of them. Said, I read them, I liked them.
Yeah.
And later she said what she liked was it was conversations between men and women, which interested her. But I know sometimes women would go for Tales of the Bean World, which I like, that Larry Marder strip. Sometimes women would go for, Myrna picks up the oddest things, Howard Cruz stuff, you know, she liked Omaha, she liked Gru, she liked the Japanese comic, Mai, the Psychic Girl.
Oh, okay.
And, you know.
She liked Nancy, right? Not Nancy, what was the one, Lil Lulu?
She liked Lil Lulu.
You bought some of those, yeah.
But, which I like all those, too. But, yeah, it's, Oh, and she picked up Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman. She thought that was hilarious.
That's a weird one, too.
And, well, like I said, everybody likes different things, and you can't fine-tune some. You would never think a woman would like Reed Fleming, World's Toughest Milkman, but yeah, she does.
Good for her.
Well, you know, like I said, people, with the exception of the two of us speaking, people are fairly complex individuals.
We're pretty simple.
Yeah.
We just eat and do stuff.
So you never really can fine-tune exactly what everybody likes. But I hate to go back to this, but you know, it's one thing I think with these French comics. They were doing these from, I think, I talked about the first one I picked up. It was from 1967 or 68. These right here are from like 71 to 73. Different kind of world. Remember the comics we used to be able to get in 71 and 73, which, I mean, when I'm saying that, they were great comics that I loved. These are far more complex in the thinking, and yet I didn't know anything about it until like 82. I know Walt Simonson was a huge fan. He couldn't read them, but he looked at it, and J.C. Mazieres was a huge influence on Walt Simonson's style. And, what was it, Kelly Freas, Gil Kane, they all liked, they were all huge fans of this artist. But
well, if you were in the business or lived in New York, you probably would have more access to the European stuff.
Exactly.
Whereas, you know, you were Miami, well, you know, I can actually take it back. In Miami, we used to get the Spanish comics.
Right.
So we would get access to some odder things, you know, and stuff like that. So there was, but I don't remember seeing any French comics back in. Even though every once in a while, I remember I used to go through the quarter bins, and I would find some, like, Daredevil from France or some Hulk from Sweden or whatever. And they always had some weird name, like La Mole or, you know, Zay, you know, Le something or other. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool, you know.
I love that kind of stuff. I love seeing it. But the French comics in Oklahoma, there's a comic store there, and he had Asterix, which I didn't know what it was. And they were expensive. This is in 1978. And the Asterix were $3.95, $4.95, which, you know, I mean, that was a lot of money for what they were at the time.
Yeah.
You get that stuff for $2. And I said, what is Asterix? And so it's a comic strip in France.
Right.
Well, expensive as they were, I bought every one of them he had. You know, I'd go in there every week. It was just astounding. Come to find out, I don't know if it is to this day, but it was the most successful comic strip in the world. And, a friend of mine had gone to Switzerland and France and stuff, and he said that every store he went to, they had a rack of Asterix, a whole wall, and there were rows of languages with all the different books and, you know, English, French, Spanish, Italian. And he said you basically just picked out whatever language you knew and bought them there.
You know, there are Asterix movies with Gerard Depardieu.
Really?
Yeah, there's a picture of it right here. Yeah, I'll save it for the show. Yeah, but I don't think they've been. I don't think they've been translated into English.
Well, what's funny? Like I can't pronounce his names. If you are French speaking, please forgive me. But the artist, his name is Albert Uderzo. And he's just fantastic. But when I read about the story about him, I've got another French comic at home called Papa, which is it's an Indian, and I'm guessing a French colonial soldier, and must be, well, you know, in America. But It looked nice, but I guess he didn't really have too much success. And then it's Rene Goscinny.
Boy, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
I heard Harvey Kurtzman talking about him in Dallas in 1982. He was born in Belgium, but I think he grew up here in the United States, or, you know, spent time in the United States. Harvey Kurtzman said he was a really good writer. And it says he was a cartoonist, and then Harvey Kurtzman said he wasn't a very good cartoonist. But he said his writing was strong. And then he went back to France, or went to France. And later, Harvey Kurtzman went to see him. And it says he was had this really nice place he lived in. He was taking him to all the best restaurants. You know, they took cabs everywhere. And at one point, Harvey Kurtzman asked him, he says, Rene, how can you afford all this? And he took him into a bookstore. It was the first bookstore he saw and pointed, and there was a wall with volume upon volume of Asterix. Well, Uderzo, I guess, didn't really have a lot of success until, you know, he teamed up with Rene Goscinny. But Asterix, like I said, it was everywhere. I've had kids from the Philippines in my house, and they see, you know, a shelf of the Asterix. They knew it from school because they were learning English with them. I've had Argentine students, students from the Czech Republic. I can't think of any country that I've dealt with people here that didn't know Asterix. I said, well, you know Asterix, they always say to me. Oh, yeah. And like I said, and they're always surprised to find out it's a French comic strip. It's gotten bigger. But I guess that's the point I'm wanting to make on this, was the comics are kind of not in the mainstream, but yet everybody listened to the Beatles. The Beatles were big in France. They were big everywhere. So, like I said, in Sylvia, what's that woman, Sylvia Vartan? You know, and what was it? There was another Frances Morley. But their music.
Oh, the one that she's married to Art Spiegelman.
Well, yeah, she's a cartoonist. But there's another one, Frances Hardy or something. I've heard some French singers that had...
The singers, I've heard of her, yeah.
But like I said, the music, sometimes it'll cross over and it's in the main consciousness, but the comics, not so much. I mean, what, it's 2000, almost 14 now, and we're finally getting Asterix, Valerian comics over here.
Yeah, Francois Hardy, yeah.
Yeah, really pretty.
Yeah, I know,
good
yeah.
Good singer, but really, really pretty.
Well, I guess the comic books are more towards kids. So
these aren't.
No, but that's what I'm saying, you know. They were more geared towards kids, so when kids read something like this, it's like reading their homework or something like that. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like...
Well, in the Asterix graphic novels, every volume on the back of it, it said you can get Asterix in these following countries. And it has 50 different countries. And one of them, it says the Roman Empire. I don't know what that joke is, you know.
The Roman Empire.
Well, because they already had Italy listed. The Roman Empire, they put it out in Latin.
Oh, okay.
And they said the reason why it wasn't a joke, it was an Asterix written in Latin, because a lot of students have to take Latin so they can get an Asterix book and basically read the language, practice. And I thought, well, that makes sense.
Oh, okay.
So, like I said, Asterix, you can read it in countless languages, including a language that only Catholic priests use.
Yeah, the thing about Asterix was, it was like, I don't remember, was there a cartoon of it? Because that would have helped.
There might have been, but...
They never saw it on TV or anything
They might have had they had a movie, because I remember in the 70s, one of the Asterix volumes I bought was The 12 Tasks of Asterix, which was an illustrated comic book of the movie. But and that was in the 70s. They must have had something since. But you know, it's one of those things. That comic is unique. The story. A friend of mine I worked with is. He was Spanish, but he also.
I'm sure he still is Spanish.
He's gone now.
Oh, he passed away. Well, he still is Spanish.
He was from Madrid, and I found out he. I was always asking about Spanish comics. And at one point, you know, I knew him for a couple of years, and we always talked about soccer, you know, but I'd ask him about comics, and finally he said, you know, you always ask me, he said, there was one comic strip that I loved when I was in Spain, and so I'm going to write my friend and ask him to send me some so I can show you. I said, it's called Asterix. And I said, I've got a bunch of those. He was surprised, so I brought them in every day. He'd get another read it. But he would tell me stuff as an American I didn't catch. Like, there were certain things. One of my favorite books was called Asterix and the Mansions of the Gods. And basically, the Romans were always trying to take care of this Gaulish village that, you know, Caesar couldn't stop. They couldn't take over. And so they basically built these giant condominiums like a resort. And the Roman women would just go into the village and buy a fish, and, you know, they see the shields the blacksmith made and the swords, and they buy them as antiques. And they were amazed at how cheap all the stuff was in that village. Well, next thing you know, the village came apart, and everybody was either a fishmonger or an antique salesman. They're all fighting each other. And the people who lived in the village couldn't afford to buy the fish or swords or anything because everything was overpriced because of the Romans. And Juan was telling me what was happening. That was when the U.S. Air Force bases started coming in Spain. He said all the military wives started using all the maids there, and the Spanish maids could make more money working for the Americans, and the Spanish couldn't afford to use maids anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it basically threw their economy upside down. And there was other things you talk about. There was always a traffic jam in this one city full of carts and, you know, wagons and stuff. And they're always fighting, and they said that's one part of Europe where it's just always traffic is bad. I mean, you know, little things, they're funny when I read them, but when he told me, it gave a completely different thing. But kind of find out, I have, you know, a bunch of French comics in French, and he reads and speaks French as well. So, you know, I started bringing, you know, other stuff over to him. He fell in love with J.C. Mézières' Valerian, and then once he read the Mobius stuff, he said the rest of it just kind of pales in the comparison. So,
The European comic, the European version of American comics are different. I got an issue of Vampirella years ago on eBay, and I got it basically because in the middle of the comic book, it's printed on, I wish I had it right here, it's in the room somewhere. It's printed on a thicker stock, and it's from 70 whatever too, and it's a Vampirella. It's got glossy paper, and in the middle of it is an article about a movie called An Angel for Satan, I think, a Barbara Steele movie. And I'm like, wow, so they kind of went all out back then. You know, the Warrens never really did that. Mm-hmm. Now, the Marvels would do a movie review sometimes in the middle of the
book,
which is actually pretty cool, but the Warrens never did. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. So.
Well, French comics, like I said, a lot of them are adult, but not all of them. There are. The Smurfs came from there. I think they were from Belgium. But those comics were done for kids. I read some, I found. They're fun. They're well drawn, and they're funny. And one of them, even though it's written for kids, it's a really good statement on modern society. So they have all different levels of comics there.
Yeah, they do. We do here now too.
Yeah.
Well,
we always have in a way. But
I think comics here are more geared for over 20s and over. I don't think they're more geared for kids, even though the Archies might be. But even the Archies are getting into all these, like, you know, adult things these days.
I guess, but Archie's the only one you can find anywhere. You find in grocery stores and stuff. The rest of them.
They still put out Disney books anymore?
I don't know.
Like they put out Popeye, but that's kind of like almost retro.
Disney doesn't put those.
They put out the hardcovers of Donald Duck and stuff like that.
Well, that's Fantagraphics. Graphics. They're just doing the Carl Barks.
So. Yeah.
In Europe, they do. You know, they put out the magazines. Donald Duck is huge in Europe.
Especially in Germany, because Pat from Comic World says whenever German tourists come by, they always ask for ducks.
Yeah, well, Holland, all those places.
Yeah,
I think Holland's probably the biggest. And they always had them ask. When I started working in the company, I'm out in the 80s, there was a woman that had a comic book from Holland, and it was Donald Duck.
There you go.
And but I've heard that they're huge there. But, and rightly so, Carl Barks is the king, you know. Jack Kirby was, but so was Carl Barks. You could have more than one king.
Jack Kirby was my king, and
I love
Carl Barks was more your king, I guess.
You can love them all. You can love
I guess, you know, I guess you can. You know, I guess you can be like, you know, Buy the World of Coke and all that good stuff. Yeah, I wanted to talk about briefly, because we're getting, like, you know, we're getting into almost the past the hour mark. I picked up an old House of Mystery over there, and I was just reading through it because you said, you need to read some comics this week, so I read one. No, maybe two. But at any rate, and there was a story in here called, it's by Bernie Wrightson, The Thing, Things Old, Things Forgotten, and it's basically about a guy who's like, he's trying to like, he wants to build a road to attack some country or whatever, and as he's building the road, he comes across these like, these green kind of like moss monsters that impede his progress, and of course, you know, they have a conflict, and, you know, moss monster wins or whatever. But what's interesting is, like, even though the monster doesn't look like Swamp Thing, it kind of is kind of a Swamp Thing. And it got me thinking, well, when did the original Swamp Thing come out? This is from October 71. Now, the original Swamp Thing tale, whatever it was, House of Mystery or whatever it was called.
I think it's House of Secrets.
House of Secrets, yeah. It was from July of 71. I'm like, oh, wow, so that's before. And I'm thinking, God, I wonder when Man Thing was released, and then that's like May of 71, so I'm like, what was the deal going on back then with all these muck monsters, you know? And it seems to me, like, from a little bit of reading that I did, that Marvel was thinking of doing a Man Thing book about a year previously, and I guess Len Wein, who created Swamp Thing, was living with, was roommates with Jerry Conway. So somehow or another, I'm thinking maybe the idea kind of like, just was in the air, so to speak. So both of them actually came out within the same time of themselves. And the original Swamp Thing was something called The Heat back in the 40s. And when I was reading, he was basically based on a Theodore Sturgeon book called It, which is about a man who becomes a monster or whatever. So it's kind of interesting about what was in the air going on back then. I mean, Swamp Thing became a big deal, and Man Thing kind of did, but he became like more of a secondary character in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, he had his own book, and then he hung out with Howard the Duck and stuff like that. But what's interesting about that book was that the cover's by Wright, and the cover it looks like it's more of a polished style. But when you look at the story, Things Old, Things Forgotten, it looks like it was done maybe like a year or more earlier. It was more of a rougher, earlier style. So I'm just wondering whether that, like, monster thing there might have been a genesis for the character. Now, I don't know who wrote that story. It might have been Len Wein. I'd have to look it up on Grand Comic Database, but kind of interesting, piqued my interest or whatever. But I didn't realize that those characters came out within 2 months of themselves. So it's, you know, obviously they were in production before, you know, it wasn't like Marvel put out Man Thing and DC rushed to put out Swamp Thing. There had to have been something going on.
See, I never read any of those when I was a kid. I remember when DC in their comics would advertise Swamp Thing coming. And I just knew it was a swamp monster. I knew a Man Thing later, and I'd see some of the comics. I always got them confused. I like Man Thing because he had those three tentacles on his face.
Yeah, right.
And which I always thought was a little creepy. I just knew that one had one and the other one had the other. Friends of mine that I knew that read them always said they liked Swamp Thing. They always said Man Thing had sorry art. I don't think it was sorry. Mike Klug drew them, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Mark Klug was great, man.
But and then like I said, it was in the 80s when Eclipse Comics was doing that Airboy comic, and they had The Heap as a backup feature. So what? Kind of find out the original Airborne comic of the 50s or 40s had The Heap. I guess he was the original Muck Monster.
Yeah, yeah, based on that Theodore Sturgeon thing.
What's that?
It was called It. I talked about it a second ago. There was a book in the 40s by Theodore Sturgeon called It, and it was about a man who became a Muck Monster. And I think The Heap came out after that.
Well, there was a night gallery when I was a kid.
Yes, I remember that.
Remember there was a swamp monster, which just blew my mind.
I think that was based on H.P. Lovecraft, too.
I absolutely love that.
Green Fingers, maybe, was called.
I couldn't remember the name
like
of it. I just remember the girl was talking at the very end. They did something to the monster, and he was in the swamp, and he blossomed. I remember my monster, ooh, he blossomed. He had all these flowers on him. And the girl came back, you know, she wasn't a little girl anymore. She was an older woman, and she came back to the swamp and was talking to him. Well, I'm back. You can't hurt me now. And then she basically told the monster she loved him, and it ended.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, I was like, you know, 9 years old. It just blew my mind. And then me and my friends were always trying to draw it. We all were just amazed by the swamp monster. And then, like I said, it wasn't long after that's when Swamp Thing and Man Thing came out.
I think it's called Midnight Never Ends.
In the Night Gallery?
Yeah, in the Night Gallery, yeah.
Well, all it tells me, I know in House of Secrets when Lynn Wein and Bernie Wrightson did that 8-page story or 6-page story about the Swamp Thing. It was just a simple throwaway story, and people kept writing and writing. It got so popular, they gave it its own book. All it tells me is people just like mug monsters.
Yeah, well, the thing, you know, I have an issue of it there. Psycho, one of those nuts guy, well, they brought back the Heap in the 70s, too. So you had him, and you had Swamp Thing, and you had Man Thing. It was a funny time, those early 70s.
Well, you know, superheroes, like I said, you had Superman, and next thing you know, you got 50 billion different superheroes, where it's ridiculous now. What if instead it was mug monsters?
Was it this thing here?
I
yeah, it says Night Gallery episode 13, Brent. Yeah, I think this was it.
It creeped me out.
I don't remember ever seeing that. I'll just save it. It sure does look like the Swamp Thing.
That's it, because the girl.
I never saw this episode. I gotta find it.
Well, you gotta rectify it.
All right, sounds good.
So, French comics and mug monsters.
There you go. That's what it's all about. All right, let's end this. This great episode, episode 70.
Well, it was fun talking to you, buddy.
Yes, sir.
If you found this and listened to this from somewhere else, you can't find this on iTunes. The last 20 episodes is on there. And if you'd like to hear earlier episodes, you can go to bunchofdorks.com and then click on the Cyclops.
Oh, wait. Before you... Okay, you click on the Cyclops first and then... You read more comics?
Well, we're not finishing yet.
Okay, all right.
Everything on the blog, you can find our earlier episodes. You can also see examples of what we talked about and links for further reading. You can find Al also on Slow Roll About a Go-Go, the B-Movie podcast with the amazing Mal. And Alice is continuing to do with the Mighty Blue, even though he's not on the show anymore.
He will be soon.
We'll see about that. And you can also find Al's fantastic blog,
Destination Nightmare,
which we were just discussing earlier. He has all kinds of stuff besides heroin addictions.
We have rock and roll. We have movies. We have comic books.
It's a wonderland. Podcasts. It's a wonderland of fun. Yes, I just listened to your last podcast with CK.
Yeah. That was an epic podcast.
It was epic, but I really enjoyed it, and
2.5 hours.
I'm embarrassed to say most of the music you played, with a couple of exceptions,
I
liked it, but...
I know, but hey, you learned something, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe you didn't.
No, I did. I enjoyed that episode. So I do recommend you go to Destination Nightmare, read the stuff, listen to the podcast after you listen to ours.
Yeah, I recommend my podcast, too, and this one, and Slow Robot. I recommend them all.
I enjoy them all. I listen to them all.
They're hubs of entertainment.
All at bunchofdorks.com.
Except mine. Mine's just outside the... I'm off the grid, but I'm there.
It's on the sidebar of the two-dimension page, which you can find, you know, on bunchofdorks.com, and you click on the Cyclops.
That's right.
And then in the meantime...
Read.
More.
Comics. The end.